Basically, almost every job I ever had was a job where I was in charge of what music was being listened to.
That's the voice of Spike Priggen, the owner and purveyor of records at Spike's Record Rack on Main Street in downtown Catskill. And I should mention, host of the Bedazzled Radio Hour here on WGXC. This is my show, Music in Time, and I'm your host, Evan McCormick, a historian and music lover. The idea behind the show is that we use music to explore the past, picking an album and exploring the context that surrounds it. But there are other ways to explore history through music, like understanding the ways that it has shaped individual people's lives. And every time I'm in Spike's shop and I pick up a record, it seems Spike has some story behind it, which got me thinking, how much history is in that shop? So I sat down with Spike for this episode of Music in Time to hear his story of a life framed by music, from working in a record shop in New Haven during the 1970s to the thriving underground music scene in New York City's 1980s and back to the Hudson River Valley of today. But it all starts back in 1975 with a radio single by the Dwight Twilley Band, I'm on Fire. That was I'm on Fire by the Dwight Twilley Band, a three-piece rock outfit out of Tulsa, Oklahoma. The Dwight Twilley Band released I'm on Fire as a single in 1975, and it was a surprise hit on the charts, fueled by massive radio play. But due to troubles with the band's label, Shelter Records, fans were left waiting more than a year for the follow-up material. One of those fans was a 12-year-old kid in New Haven, Connecticut, named Michael Spike Priggen. And that's where we began our interview. All right, you are listening to Music in Time on WGXC. I'm your host, Evan McCormick, and I am joined today by Spike Priggen, the owner and purveyor of records at Spike's Record Rack in downtown Catskill. Spike, thanks for joining us.
Hey, sure, my pleasure.
All right, so I want to start this interview by asking you about how you got your start in the record-selling business.
Well, when I was about 12 years old, I got a job at a record store in New Haven, Connecticut called Cutler's. You can imagine how much time I had already spent there for them to give a 12-year-old a job. I worked on Thursday nights because that was the only night they were open late, and I worked Saturdays during the day from about 76 to 80.
76 to 80?
Yeah.
And was it common for a 12-year-old to land a job in retail at that
No.
time? No. Yeah, it strikes me as pretty extraordinary. So what got you interested in music in the first place at age 12?
I was always obsessed with music, obsessed with the AM radio. I would keep a notebook where I would write down the entire, like, Casey Kasem American Top 40 before I realized that there was a magazine called Billboard that you could just buy and it would be inside of there. So I've just always been obsessed with music, always obsessed with the AM radio, you know, knew all the hits, collected 45s when I was a little kid.
What kind of jobs did they reserve for the 12-year-old on staff?
Well, actually, I worked in the import / 45 department. The main reason that I got that job there, I think, was there was a guy that worked in that 45 department that was the head of that import 45 department, Larry Dorfman, who just kind of like semi-adopted me. He was like kind of like my rock and roll big brother. But there was we weren't involved in any kind of Big Brother program. But yeah, he really took me under his wing, and you know, I got to do so many great things because of Larry Dorfman.
So the record that we're featuring today, as we start your story in the mid to late 70s, is the Dwight Twilley Band's "Sincerely," which came out in 76, right?
I think it came out in 76. Yeah.
Do you have a memory of hearing it and what caught your ear with it?
Yeah. Well, I was waiting for it to come out because they had a big hit around 75 called I'm on Fire, which I purchased at Merle's Record Rack in New Haven. That was a little closer to my house than Cutler's was. I don't know if I'd made it quite to Cutler's when that record was out. But, you know, I was already a fan of that record when I started working at Cutler's. And then I just remember, you know, knowing that it was going to come out and waiting for it to come out, and it took quite a while for them to record a record and get it out.
Baby, let's move.
So we're here in Spike's Record Rack today, and I'm looking at a Dwight Twilley Band poster. You told me this is a more recent vintage, but you had an original that was that
I've owned a Cutler's. Version of that poster since I worked at Cutler's. My original one got pretty beat up, and then maybe 15 or 20 years ago, Dwight was offering them for sale on his website, and so I purchased one and just recently got it framed.
What struck you about the sound of the Dwight Twilley Band?
You know, I don't know if I could quantify it. It just appealed to me. I mean, part of it is they had a weird thing, which is they were kind of influenced by the Beatles and Elvis. Like, it was like power pop, but with like kind of a rockabilly nuance to it, which is pretty unusual, you know. It's funny, that kind of sound was kind of more popular in Memphis, but they're from like Tulsa, I think.
Right, yeah. So you've mentioned two record stores in New Haven in the late 70s. This seems like this was kind of the heyday of vinyl.
Yeah, there were probably five record stores in downtown New Haven that I could walk to. There was Cutler's, Merle's Record Rack. There was Rhymes Records later on. There was Festoons. At least four that I could walk to.
Any sense at that point that records and music were going to kind of frame your life story here?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I started playing in bands when I was like maybe 13, 14 years old. Yeah, that was always going to be what I did with my life.
That was Feeling in the Dark by the Dwight Twilley Band off their debut album, Sincerely. Spike told me off air that he saw the Dwight Twilley Band around this time in Bridgeport, Connecticut at a bar called Barnaby's. But that wasn't all the live music that Spike was taking in. In fact, he was about to be swept up in the wave of punk and post-punk that was burgeoning in New Haven at the time. And he told me all about it and the way that the record stores served as a vital hub for this scene.
From 76 to 80, between the ages of 12 to 16, I was basically able to get into any show I wanted to go to. Like, there's a big club in New Haven, kind of a famous club called Toad's Place. I would be on the guest list at Toad's Place. I would go, I'd give them my name, they'd cross my name off the list and let me in. There was no carding for some reason. If you were on the list, they just assumed you were old enough somehow. So I got to see a lot of great shows that I should not have been allowed to attend.
Did that have to do with you working at Cutler's? Is there a connection between
the venues? Because I could get on the guest list, you know, through the labels or whatever, you know.
Yeah. Any memorable stories of acts coming through New Haven in the late 70s?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I saw everybody. I saw Elvis Costello in a tiny little club in New Haven. In that same club, I saw a Magazine. I saw Richard Hell and the Voidoids. Some bands that played at that club that I missed, B-52s, Plasmatics. Because New Haven was kind of equidistant from Boston and New York, almost everybody that was going to play those cities would play New Haven as well, you know. So we really got almost everybody. I actually opened for a bunch of interesting bands at Toad's Place. A band I was in called TV Neats opened up for Joan Jett and the Blackhearts and the Stranglers. And the Stranglers thing was funny because the Stranglers made our bass player, Chip, take off his black leather gear that he was wearing because they had it in their contract that only they could wear black leather on stage. Well, I played in a whole succession of bands in New Haven before I moved away to New York City. So the very first one was called The Special Guests. That was originally supposed to be called Keith and the Reamers, and a guy named Keith Reamer, that was his real name. His punk name, he had been the lead singer of a band called The Snots, and his punk name was Daryl Leck. But we decided that Keith Reamer was more punk rock than Daryl Leck. So we were going to have this band called Keith and the Reamers. And unfortunately, Keith Reamer died of a heroin overdose before that band could happen. So that band continued on as the Special Guests. And I was more or less the lead singer. And that was it was a husband and wife team. Tom and Greta Garbage were the bass player and the keyboard player. So then the Special Guest is my first band. Then I was in a band called The Obvious, which was a punk band again. I played guitar in that. That featured Mark Mulcahy and Ray Neal, that later on formed a band called Miracle Legion that were one of the more popular bands from that era from New Haven. After The Obvious, I was in a band called The Excerpts, which featured a guy named John Bryan, who's actually very famous now and composes soundtracks for movies like Punch Drunk Love and Magnolia. And I guess those are 20 years ago, but that he's on that level. After The Excerpts, I was in a band called TV Neats, which was a power pop, kind of punky poppy band, and that featured a guy named Rick Orlando that now is in this area, or for the past 20-25 years has been a chef in this area and is pretty famous. But my wife and I were driving around listening to the NPR station and Rick was on there getting interviewed. So and that was like a punky poppy band. And then from there, because my last band I was in New Haven was called Stray Divides. And that also featured Mark and Ray from Miracle Legion. Mark was the drummer at that point. And it also featured a guy named Kirk Swan, who went on to form a band called Dump Truck in Boston, which I also later was a member of.
So there's an entire music scene in New Haven, it sounds like, at this point, that you're kind of moving through.
Yeah, we had a great punk rock new wave scene in Connecticut. There was really a lot of good stuff happening.
Did the record store, Cutler's or Merle's or any of the others, did those serve as kind of like meeting points for the musicians like yourself and others in New Haven?
I mean, I knew everyone in the New Haven punk rock and new wave scene before there was a scene. Yeah. One of the first people I met when I was working at Cutler's, a guy came in, this guy Craig Bell came in and traded in his 45 collection. So we could buy a bunch of like punk rock 45s. Craig Bell had just moved from Cleveland, where he had been in a band called Rocket from the Tombs, which basically split into two bands, Pere Ubu and the Dead Boys. So Craig and this guy Peter Lochner, who's a pretty famous rock critic and musician, were the only guys from the that band that didn't end up in one of those two bands, you know. And Craig actually co-wrote Final Solution, one of the most famous Peru Ubu songs. So yeah, I knew, you know, I knew all of these people before they were even putting bands together and stuff, you know.
And it was all kind of happening at the record store.
From being at the record store, yeah, for sure.
You're listening to Music in Time on WGXC. I'm your host, Evan McCormick, and today we're using music to explore some personal history in my interview with Spike Priggen, who runs Spike's Record Rack on Main Street in downtown Catskill. That song was The Backyard by Miracle Legion, one of the bands that was in Spike's orbit during his formative musical years in high school in New Haven, Connecticut. And where we left off in the interview, Spike was about to head down the Empire service line from New Haven to New York City. But as you'll hear, those musicians from his record store days in New Haven were never far out of the picture.
I moved to New York City in 1982, almost, you know, right out of high school. And, you know, I probably had made the decision that I was going to move to New York City right out of high school when I was maybe nine. I got into School of Visual Arts for photography. I studied photography in high school at a place called Educational Center for the Arts. Now, they did have a music program, but I was just kind of like too punk rock to want to study music. Although, oddly enough, I was in a power pop band with John Bryan, and John Bryan did study music at the Educational Center for the Arts, and he was the drummer in the jazz band. At the same time, he was, you know, playing lead guitar in the power pop band with me. And he was a phenomenal drummer. I mean, the guy's a world-class musician on every instrument, Basically.
What a wild time to be in New York. What kind of music were you taking in? Where were you interacting with?
Well, you know, I basically had one incomplete year at School of Visual Arts because towards the end of my first year, I got a job at a club called Danceteria, which arguably was the coolest, best nightclub in the world at that point. It was four floors. Each floor was almost like a different club. And then in the warm weather months, the roof was open as well. I was listening to a lot of, you know, a lot more dancey kind of music and stuff. Although the very first band that I started in New York consisted of me, a woman named Nicole Willis, and a guy named Dimitri Brill. Dimitri went on to, and that band was very minimal, like Young Marble Giants, very influenced by Young Marble Giants, and this band Weekend, that was Allison Statton's band after Young Marble Giants. So it was like very quiet, kind of pseudo bossa nova music. We never played a gig, we only played in like Dimitri or Nicole's bedroom in Brooklyn. But Dimitri did go on to be DJ Dimitri Daddio in the band Delight, Groove is in the Heart. And Nicole Willis moved to Finland and married a famous Finnish techno guy, Jimmy Tenor, and then had a career, still has a career in Finland as kind of a retro soul singer. She had a record out about 20 years ago called Keep Reaching Up by Nicole Willis and the Soul Investigators. It's pretty amazing. It's a really, really good record.
Reaching out for the real thing, yeah.
That was Keep Reaching Up by Nicole Willis and the Soul Investigators off the 2005 album of the same name. Nicole Willis was one of Spike's collaborators in 1980s New York City, one of many, as you'll hear in the interview. Back to it.
So let's talk about record stores in New York at the time. Were you, was that a part of your music experience there? What were the places you'd go to buy records, or was it mainly happening at that point in the clubs and the rehearsal
spaces? No, it was still vinyl at that point. You know, where were the record stores I would shop at? It was always St. Mark Sounds. I bought a lot of stuff there. There was a record store in Soho called Rocks in Your Head.
Well, how about the bands that you were in at this time when you were producing music? Were you more excited to see your stuff on vinyl or cassette at this point? Then we're kind of getting closer to the CD years.
I didn't really get a record released until 1987. And that was, so after that band I had with Nicole Willis and Dimitri Brill was actually called The Blue Period. Then Dimitri wasn't involved in it anymore, and it was just me and Nicole. And that we called The Hello Strangers. And basically, every band I had for maybe almost the next 10 years was also called the Hello Strangers. So the thing that we had was this kind of like bossa nova thing. It was kind of like early Everything But the Girl. Where in early Everything But the Girl, it was just sort of Ben Watt would play guitar and Tracy Thorn would sing. And that's all it was. It was just I would play guitar and she would sing. Eventually, we added some percussion and drums and stuff. But we played around a few gigs, you know, not very many in that lineup. Then I didn't really do much music in New York City after that. The next thing that happened was I got a gig roadieing for this band Beat Rodeo, who are friends of mine. Steve Almas was a bartender with me at Danceteria, and Bill Shunk, the guitar player, was somebody that I hung out with a lot at Danceteria. So I did that for 6 or 8 months, and then in the middle of being a roadie for Beat Rodeo, my friends of mine from New Haven who had moved to Boston, had a band called Dump Truck, called me up and I got offered the bass slot in Dump Truck. So I moved to Boston for a year, played bass in Dump Truck for a year on tour, a year or so, and then that all fell apart, and then I had to move back to New Haven. Started another band that was also called The Hello Strangers, but it was like a four-piece, two guitars, bass, drum band that was, you know, sort of like American indie, post-REM kind of music, jangly guitars and etc. And I made an album in 1987, The Hello Strangers Goodbye, that came out on the Incas label, which was a New Haven or a Connecticut indie label.
You recorded it in New Haven as well?
Yeah, I recorded it at a place called Presence Studios.
So I tried to get a Hello Stranger song from Spike, but that didn't quite work out. So here's one from Dump Truck's 1987 album, For the Country. That's just about the time that they brought Spike on to play bass. Here's Going Nowhere.
Get myself and walk.
So at some point, if I had this right, you also had a record label.
Yeah. That was in the like early 90s. That was the original vinyl resurgence. Kind of like in the early 90s, a lot of people started putting out indie rock 45s. So, you know, I guess we just kind of jumped on that bandwagon. I was in a bunch of different bands. I was in actually four different bands that all put out a record on that label. The label was basically run by me, and the other main mover was a guy named Robert Vickers, who had been the bass player in the Go-Betweens for many years. He and I first played together in a band called Big Louise, which was these twin sisters, Leslie and Laura Sink, that I met because they were big Mark Mulcahy Miracle Legion fans. And they were both singers and songwriters, and so we started a band with them called Big Louise, which is named after a Scott Walker song. And coincidentally, a fellow record store owner friend of mine, Doug Weigel from Rocket Number 9 in Kingston, was the drummer in that band. Then there was another band called The Caroline No, which was my friend Steve Rand, which was nominally a... I guess it started in Northampton, then moved to New York City, then moved back to Northampton again. My band, The Hello Strangers, I was still calling it The Hello Strangers at this point. This actually might have been more like 89, 90, something like that. And there's actually a great lineup of The Hello Strangers on that. That's Doug Weigel on drums as well. I played bass. The guitar players were a guy named Kevin Salem. That was one of the in a later version of Dump Truck. And a guy named Ward Dotson that had been in the Gun Club and had a band called the Pontiac Brothers that was pretty popular.
Yeah. So this, when did you start putting out CDs? You started, you left behind the band names anyway and started releasing as
Spike Priggen,
right?
You know, throughout the 90s, I was in the late 80s, early 90s. I moved back to New York City, I guess, in 89 from my Boston, New Haven sojourn. So, you know, I was playing in a bunch of bands. Like, literally, at one point, I was in the Pussy Willows. I was playing gigs in the Shrams. I had my own country band that was playing gigs. Big Louise was playing gigs. So I was literally in like six or eight bands at once. In 1994, I took a settlement from a landlord that I had won of about $10,000. And I basically took that and I went to Europe for 6 or 8 months and did some music over there. I played on a record by a guy named Malcolm Ross. Malcolm Ross had been in Joseph K. He'd been in all of the great Scottish indie rock bands that I loved. He was in Joseph K. Then he was in Orange Juice. Then he was in Aztec Camera. So I got to play on half of a Malcolm Ross record that was recorded in Brooklyn at my roommate Mark Spencer's studio, The Tape Kitchen. Then I got to play on the other half of the record, which we recorded in London with Edwin Collins of Orange Juice producing and recording it. So that was cool. Played a few gigs, did a bit of busking. Yeah, Malcolm Ross and I started a version of my kind of country 60s rock cover band that would play around there and did a bit of recording. I did a demo actually with a guy who's the same guy that recorded all the Vaseline's records. He came to one of these gigs that we had done and just kind of said, hey, do you have any original songs? Do you want to come in my studio and record them? So I took him up on that. That was cool.
Yes, very cool. Here's Sorry for Laughing by Malcolm Ross's band Joseph K, released in 1981 on Le Disque Crepuscule.
It took 10 years to realize why the angels start to cry. Don't take it hard.
So let's bring it forward to the shop. When, give us the backstory on when and how you decided to open the record rack here in Catskill.
Well, you know, for quite a few years in the 90s and early 2000s, I made a pretty good living buying and selling rare music video on DVD. Now, these weren't counterfeit things. They were just things that were unavailable commercially. And I did quite well selling those things for quite a few years until they invented a thing called YouTube. And then nobody wanted to pay for rare video anymore. So I'd be doing these record shows, which is where I mostly sold these things. I'd be looking around and everybody that was selling vinyl records was doing a great, you know, business. And I wasn't. So, you know, eventually I just got cards printed up that say I buy records and I became a record dealer. So, you know, when I first started out doing it, I was selling online. I was selling at record shows and I would I'd have kind of big vinyl only yard sales on my porch in Coxsackie. And I, you know, I started thinking about having a store back then, and I always, you know, thought about like what town I would do it in, and I wanted to do it in Catskill because it was the first town we lived in when we moved up here. We always liked Main Street. I have friends that own record stores, a record store in Kingston. I know there are record stores in Albany. Hudson has a record store, so I just figured this would be the place that I would do it if and when this town got hip enough to, you know, for it to be a success. And then, you know, about early 2018, the Hi-Lo had been open for a while and had been really successful right out of the gate. My friend Deb Parker, that had a kind of a collectibles store in Ravenna or New Baltimore, Sister Salvage, she was opening up a location on Main Street. So I just thought like, maybe it's time, you know. So I started looking at real estate on Main Street, and I contacted an old employer of mine to see if he wanted to back me in a record store. That was actually the first step, and that happened. And you know, I started looking for a location, and there weren't very many open locations. So, but I did find the place and managed to sign a lease with a guy, we opened in the original location on April 7th, 2018.
Wow. And so it has to be a completely different world from when you started working at age 12 in 1976 in Cutler's. But what are some of the ways that you find most striking about the way we think differently about vinyl and about buying records now?
Well, you know, I mean, back then, if you wanted to listen to a song, you know, on choose to listen to when you were going to listen to it, you had to own it on a vinyl record. Or I guess a cassette or an 8-track tape, but, you know, those are always inferior formats, you know. So, you know, I mean, the people that are collecting now, it's not like it's your only choice for listening to music. So it's, you know, you have to make a decision to want to be a record collector and a record owner, you know. And thankfully, more and more people are doing that all the time. There's a lot more free stuff in the 70s, you know, like all, like it was, I was just, you know, free promos and free posters and things like, you know, just weird promotional, free promotional items. Like I remember having things like an Elvis Costello, My Aim Is True dartboard with Elvis's picture in the bullseye, you know, and just all kinds of, you know, also, you know, payola was still pretty rampant at that point in time. I remember, you know, basically the way they would write the charts up at that point is my direct, the guy that was right above me in the 45 department there, Larry Dorfman, he'd get a phone call and they'd ask him, what's selling? What are the hottest records? Well, you know, what he would say would be what the promo guys that we liked from whatever label that were giving us all the free stuff would say was the hottest thing, you know?
So I was here last week for your ribbon cutting. Congratulations. What was that commemorating?
Well, basically, you know, the store did open over 4 years ago across the street, but I never joined the Chamber of Commerce. So that's basically something the Chamber of Commerce does for you. So I figured, you know, with the new move and the new location, it would be a good time to do a grand reopening. Since I had never done one.
And you tied it back to your New Haven roots.
Yeah, my mom came up from New Haven with some New Haven pizza and New Haven Italian pastries and cookies and stuff, which she did for, you know, when we originally opened the store across the street.
Yeah. All right, well, I know this is only a fraction of the stories that you could tell, Spike, from being in your shop, but I appreciate you sharing them with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks.
So that wraps up my interview with Spike Priggen. I want to thank Spike for coming on my show, letting me use him as a guinea pig for this format, exploring history through one person's relationship with music as part of their life story. Spike's perfect for this because he's always got a tale to tell, something you will know or find out if you ever stop in the shop. But it's a format I'd love to try again, focusing on other members of our community. Did you like it? Do you have suggestions? I'd love to know. Find me on social media and drop me a note. In the meantime, I'm going to send you off with one of Spike's solo cuts. This is Every Broken Heart off of his 2002 album, The Very Thing You Treasure. I don't know about you, but this is one where I definitely hear some of that Dwight Twilley Band influence on his songwriting.
I never
broken heart is like the first one. Every broken heart is like the first one. Just like every broken heart.
That's All She Wrote for Music in Time on WGXC. I'm your host, Evan McCormick, and I'll be back on the fourth Wednesday of October for another Sonic Trip.